We certainly have a very good crowd tonight, both in quality and quantity. We're glad you're here tonight and pleased to have you study with us in the Lord's Word. We want to encourage all of you to be present next week at Napoleon, and Brother Wilbur will be there speaking, even as you are here tonight, and encouraging us by your presence here. I'll talk to Brother Wilbur, Lord willing, later on tonight concerning some work we have going on in Texas, but he's in Louisiana and holding a meeting there this week. But he'll be with you next week in Napoleon, and certainly want you to be there with him at that time. It's a little unusual for me to be asking you to go when I won't be there, but I'll be in New Mexico, and so I can't be, but my heart will be there anyway with you. This week we have discussed several issues that have to do with questions that have been asked time and time again, and some recently about things that we have had for our subject matter. And tonight we continue on the question that has been asked, and quite often is asked. Some of you have asked me several times about the question of what lies beyond death. And it's always a question, just about everywhere we go, people wonder about it. Of course, there's reasons, because we haven't been there. We don't know anybody who has been. And the question always arises of the uncertainty. And certainly that's where we stand tonight. And thinking about these matters, I want to suggest to you that as we study this, we're not trying to go into detail about things we don't understand. And there's so many things about what lies beyond death that we cannot understand because they have not been revealed. And certainly we don't want to speculate, but the Lord has not allowed us to dig into the depths of these matters. But several things He has said and told us, either in figurative language or in some way, we can get a slight insight to these matters. So we hope to talk about those things. But so often when you think in terms of life beyond death and things that are not too certain and things that I have a lot of questions about them, then sometimes people tend to think of what is literally spoken as opposed to figuratively spoken. And in doing so, we get a distorted idea sometimes of what is being spoken about in the Bible. By that I simply mean this. The Bible cannot speak in terms of things that are beyond this life to let us fully understand, because it's not a material world. It's a world wherein we have not been. We cannot understand completely because we never experienced those kind of things yet in this world, because everything we know can either be touched or tasted or felt or seen or heard in some way. So when then we project ourselves beyond the limits of a material world, we're lost. And so the Lord sees fit then to give us lost in understanding, I should say, I guess. When the Lord then sees fit to describe those things to us, He must describe them in terms of things we do understand, so that we are able then to get a view of those matters, even though a limited view of those matters. But He does tell us about those in beautiful terms. Now, last night we went into detail about some things that I want to go over again slightly tonight. And the reason why is because, of course, I did not cover all the scriptures that could have been used, and all those that quite often are spoken to us about these matters, and sometimes questions asked about those, because time just did not permit. And I went over about 10 minutes last night. But there are a few that I want to mention to you tonight to understand, let you understand from those who might have had questions that were not answered last night, about some things I mentioned that I think probably need to be repeated. I've talked on this subject in several places where several of you have been, and you know that. But last night and tonight, I'm going a little deeper in these matters and going a little bit beyond what we have in the past. So I have ventured into some things that I think I need to repeat. For one thing, last night I said that there is no judgment day in the sense that we normally think of a judgment day. Now, the Bible speaks in a number of places about a day of judgment. So don't misunderstand me. We are going to be judged. Every one of us are going to be judged. Last night we showed from the Bible that we are going to be judged. But when we think in terms of a judgment day, so often people think in terms of some set day in the future, a time we don't know about, but at some set day in the future when everybody who's ever lived, billions and billions of people, are going to stand before the Lord, perhaps in line, and one by one come before Him, and they'll be judged according to their deeds done in this body. Now, the Bible does tell us we're going to be judged according to the deeds done in this body, and that's very plain and very evident. We're going to be judged by the Word of God, and the Bible tells us we're going to be judged by Jesus and God. So those things are evident. But there's no place in the Bible that tells us there is a grand, glorious judgment day at which this occurs, at which judgment is then made, having not been made before. Now, let me repeat that. there's no grand day in the future at some time when the judgment is to be made that has not been made before. Now, there is coming a time of separation. That separation time is spoken of as at the end of the world, when in Matthew chapter 25, the Bible tells us we're going to be separated as sheep from the goats, the sheep on the right hand, the goats on the left. Now, there's going to be a time that that occurs, of course, but the judgment has already been made. Now, last night we said the word judgment has several meanings, and it does. Now, one of those is simply having to do with the matter of an accusation or a damnation. And judgment of some kind can be making the decision. But the decision as to our whereabouts beyond death is made at the time of our death by the Lord. Now, we have found that true last night because very plainly showed that in Luke 16, when two men died, one went to a place of comfort and peace, while the other went to a place of torment. And the world was still going on. Time had not ended when they were judged to go to these separate places. So that in itself shows very, very plainly that judgment takes place at death. The rich man, as you recall, referred to his brethren who were still on the earth. And they at that time were living in the present life. And he remembered them. And he asked for the Lazarus to go back and talk to them, lest they come to this awful place of torment. So before time had ended, before time had come to an end, wherein many think a judgment will then be made, the judgment had already been made. So don't get confused in reading the Bible between a day of judgment and the judgment day, as sometimes we call it. A day of judgment is mentioned many, many times, simply meaning a time when God is going to make a judgment on various ones. Now, these various ones are spoken of several times in the Bible at being condemned because they're evil or being commended because they're righteous. God has made those judgments many, many times, sometimes to the point of actually having those people killed before the end of time, of course, came, before their normal death would have come. So we made that statement last night. Now, to go a little farther, as we read in the book of Revelation chapter 20, we mentioned, too, the devil being cast in the lake of fire. Now, the devil being cast into the lake of fire is yet future. Now, listen to me carefully. Don't want anybody to misunderstand. This is where we're going a little deeper than sometime we have before. At least I haven't often gone this deep before. I do not find any reference in the Bible at all that hell is in existence at this time. Now, there's going to be a hell, yes. And I don't know the mind of God completely. There may be a hell now. But you see, hell is not a place that's so many miles this way and such direction that way. Hell is a condition of lost souls. And the Bible tells us that the devil and his angels will be cast into the lake of fire at the end of time. Now, where's the devil now? He's not in hell. He hasn't been cast there yet. His angel's not there yet. Where is the devil now? We turn in the Bible to find some things about that. In the book of Revelation chapter 20 and verse 10, it begins to tell us about those matters as we turn and read. And he carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me that great city of the heaven, Jerusalem. I'm sorry, I'm reading chapter 21. Chapter 20, verse 10. And I fell at his feet to worship him, and he said unto me, I'm sorry, I turned two pages at once. Forgive me, if you will. Maybe I get the right verse this time. I'll read it first before I start reading to you. There it is. Revelation chapter 20, verse 10. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophets are, and shall be tormented day and night forever. So you see, at the end of time, then the devil is then going to be cast into that lake of fire. He's not there yet. Now, where is he? As we discussed last night in Revelation chapter 12, and also the Old Testament by this out too, the devil sinned in heaven. He opposed God, was cast out into the earth. Now, that's where he went when he was cast out of heaven, and that's where he approached Adam and Eve. He's been here ever since that time. He's still here. He will never leave this earth under the time. And then, when the earth is destroyed, he'll be cast in the lake of fire with his angels as well. We turn now to the book of 1 Peter in chapter 5 and verse 8. Notice it says here very plainly the words that you've heard many, many times, Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil. Now, when are we talking about? We're talking about right now. He said, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour. So the devil is still here. The devil is still walking about. The devil's angels are present with us now, as are God's angels, and they will remain here until the time of the end, at which time they'll be cast into the lake of fire. So in order to clear up our minds on some things that many times have been a question, or sometimes we have inherited a denominational point of view, understand simply then that we are just when we die, and the devil is still active and will be active and will not be cast into hell until the end of time comes. I hope this might clear up some of those things that might be in the minds of some until we get to the point at which we go a little deeper. When we think in terms of life beyond death, it's good for us to think in terms of the fact that as we stand at an open grave and see the body of one of our loved ones there, it's not all gloom, it's not all dreary, not all dreadful. If that loved one happens to be a member of the Lord's church, a child of God, and one who's in a safe condition, because it is necessary for him to die before he can live eternally. So death, you see, is an event in life that must come to all of us. Hebrews said, as I mentioned last night, chapter 9, it's appointed unto man once to die, but after this, the judgment. And so we are judged when we die, and we're separated, as we mentioned, before the end of time. But the fact is, when the end of time has come, and eternity has in its fullness bloomed for us, then the righteous will go from this state of death they have been in, and to ascend forevermore in a place of peace and pleasure and joy. So death to the child of God, then, is not a gloomy thing. It might separate us as far as our feelings are concerned. Our loved ones are no more in our sight and present that we might talk with them and communicate with them. We miss them, yes. Their presence is a sad thing for us to miss. But it's a joy to know that if they're righteous, they're in a far, far better place than we are now, many times free from pain and sorrow and sadness. So it's much, much easier for us as a Christian to bear the death of a loved one, and someday for our loved ones to bear our own death because we are righteous and because we're saved. But for the unrighteous, it's a gloomy time because there's no hope of a life beyond. Now, we talked about that last night, and we have that mentioned over and over again in many of our sermons. Let's think in terms now of what happens beyond death. Where do we go? We mentioned that last night. We said we go to a place that we refer to in the Bible as Hades. In the Old Testament, it's called Sheol. And those of you who have a copy of it might read the book of Josephus. Josephus is a book that's about 2.5 inches thick. Very, very difficult reading. It was written about 2,000 years ago. He was a Jew. He lived the time of Christ, or just after Christ. And in his writings, he wrote about Hades. You can read that today. So Hades is that place, and that's not the right term, but I don't know what else to use. It's that place where spirits of the dead go. The body goes to the grave, but the spirit goes to a place beyond the grave. The grave only holds the body. And when that spirit goes to that place, he's separated either in a part of it that is good and righteous and holy and pleasant, or a place that's in torments. Now, Hades is where we go when we die. But beyond Hades, what's to be taking place there? And what must we think in terms of our existence? What's going to be like after this life is over? After time has come to an end, the devil's cast in the lake of fire, and we are indeed in a place called heaven. What's it going to be like there? Well, there's some very unusual opinions as to what's going to occur. I want to read to you one of those opinions. This is from a book that's published by the Mormon Church. It was written by a man whose name was Timberland Riggs, and the book is called A Skeptic Discovers Mormonism. Now, Mormons have a lot of strange views. Many of those views are not normally known by most people. They don't tell you those views until you get indoctrinated with their doctrine. But here's what he says in regard to that matter. That we are the race of gods, destined eventually to be gods, even as he is now. Now, if you talk to some of the Mormons, and you let them go beyond what they normally teach on the surface, they'll tell you that we are destined as saved people to eventually go to a situation beyond death where we become God. Not the same God, but we become a God. And we're going to have people serving us like now we serve God. So they believe in a far, far remote situation where all of us who are saved are going to become gods in the life beyond death. Of course, the Bible doesn't for one moment mention that and doesn't allude to it in any way whatsoever. But that's their view nonetheless. That's one view. Now, another view is that the memory of those who have passed on is going to be completely erased to the point at which in heaven you're not going to remember anything about this world. And that this is going to all be in the past. Everything will be new. And you'll be in a dimension of life that this world will have passed to the point at which there'll be no sorrow, no sadness, no things of that nature. We sang several hymns tonight that I think were very fitting for the lesson. But one of those was in number 403. Listen to the words that you sang tonight. No tears in heaven, no sorrow given. All will be glory in that land. There will be no sadness, all will be gladness when we shall join that happy band. No tears in heaven, no tears in heaven, no tears up there. Sorrow and pain will all have ceased. No tears in heaven will be known. Now, we've seen that. But do we really understand what it says? Well, I think we do. It says very plainly that in heaven there will be no sadness, no sorrow, no pain or regret. But it doesn't say we won't have any memory. You see, in the place called Hades, we found that the rich man did indeed remember. He said, Abraham said, remember what happened to you back in life. So see, beyond death there was memory. But when we get to a place that's called heaven, then many of our friends who don't understand these matters say it could not possibly be that we'll have knowledge then of what's going on now. Because if we did, as a mother or father, and our child happens not to appear into heaven with us, and we know it's our child that's not there, therefore he must be in hell, then we couldn't help but be in sadness and sorrow. There's no way we cannot have regret if we know that our child is not up here with us. Let's reverse that. If you get up to heaven and find your mother or father's not there, what would you feel like? You see, what we're thinking about is about like we think now. Now, the problem with this kind of reasoning and so many other questions than just the one I've raised is this. We're not going to think then like we are now. We're not going to have a body. We're not going to have those kind of things that will interrupt our normal life by sickness and by having accidents, even by having death. Those things won't be present there. We'll be in a completely different arrangement, different dimension than we are now. So, no, it's not a question of whether you will remember or not. You will remember, as we'll see in just a few minutes. But the point is, we won't be troubled over those things because we will have matured spiritually to the point that we now can think in terms of full understanding as opposed to now we're very, very limited. Now, if you think in terms of somebody being lost, let's first of all put the burden on God's lap. Every one of us belongs to God. Every child who's ever died belongs to God. Every person who's ever been killed in a wreck belongs to God. And every single person who ever goes to hell belongs to God. He created all of us. Now, if anybody's to be sad, shouldn't God be sad? If anybody's going to be sad, it'll be God. Because we all belong to Him and He lost us and we're in hell. No, that's not the question at all. You see, the point is, we're not going to think then like human beings because we won't be human beings. We'll be different from human beings. So as a consequence of that, just get this thinking out of your mind. You're going to have a mature thought. You'll know simply this, that if my child is not in heaven, and I know he's not in heaven, I'll understand that he shouldn't be in heaven. And the reason why is because God allows in heaven only those who should be there. If God let into heaven somebody that was not prepared to go there, he'd corrupt heaven. That's the reason God cast the angels out of heaven, because it's not a place of corruption. We'll understand then that if I'm not there, or my child's not there, it's right because we shouldn't be there. So you see, God's not going to make a mistake. If I don't go to heaven, it's my fault, not God's. If I don't go to heaven, I deserve to go where I go. Because I haven't responded to God as I should. My mother and my father, if they understand that, will know the reason why. So we have a completely different idea and attitude about these matters compared to what so many, many people in this world around us have. I think we can also understand very, very simply that all the details of life after death are not revealed to us. And so we can't understand, and we can't answer, and we can't even know to ask all the questions that might be interesting to ask about life beyond death. We just simply don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us about it, and consequently, as a result of that, we have no way of looking into those things. But there are some things the Bible tells us that we can understand. Now, if God were to tell us some things that we would like to know, we probably couldn't understand it anyway. In not understanding these things, we'd be confused. Now, let me give you an illustration of that. Paul, on one occasion, while speaking in chapter 12 of 2 Corinthians, beginning with verse 2, he said, "I knew a man in Christ above 14 years ago, whether in body I cannot tell, or whether out of the body I cannot tell." Paul says, I don't know whether it was in or out of the body. But he says, "Such an one caught up to the third heaven." Now, we won't have time to go into this. We will someday if you want to. But you see the first heaven. The second heaven is the paradise where Christ went, where the thief on the cross went, and where Lazarus went. And the third heaven is the eternal heaven where God is. Now, that's beyond our vision. Now, Paul says, "I was called to that third heaven, the heaven where God is, and I knew such a man, whether in body or out of the body, I cannot tell, God knoweth, how that he was caught up into paradise." So see, paradise is mentioned as part of that second heaven where Lazarus was, also the same words used to refer to that third heaven, which is God's eternal heaven. The word paradise, in many other words, has two meanings. It says here that I heard unspeakable words which it was not lawful for man to utter. So Paul says, when I was there, when whoever it was there, and we think it might have been Paul because of other writings he mentioned about 14 years ago. So whoever it was, he says they could not tell us the things he saw. Now why? Well, one point of view is that he couldn't tell us because God didn't want him to, didn't want us to know. But I'm inclined to think that it's not that it would be unlawful in the sense of violating God's will, but it would be so impossible for him to describe the glories of heaven to us that we couldn't understand it if he did. You can understand, you can tell some things to a child. Let's suppose a 2-year-old child. Try to explain childbirth to that child. He can understand it. You can hear words. He can talk about my mother's stomach, where my little sister's going to come from. He can talk about that. But to understand childbirth, he can't understand it at 2 years old. But when you get to be 12 years old and 22 years old, yes, you can then. So Paul says, in effect, I think, that we're not mature enough. We don't have the spiritual insight enough to understand those things, so it's just not lawful for me to tell it to you. I'm inclined to think that's what he meant. But the point is, anyway, he couldn't tell us what he saw. And then we read further on also in the book of Revelation that there was a time there where he mentions that John himself was talking here about some things that were being uttered to him. He said there were 7 thunders that spoke. And he said that the voice told him, "Do not write what these 7 thunders uttered." Now, why? There's something there God didn't want us to understand or have or know. I think probably we understand that. Brother Charlie Sheldon, many years ago, said he thought what that was a dictate of the Pope. Since we're talking about the Pope in these verses. He said if the Pope had issued a decree and John mistook that for the voice of God and put it in the Bible, we'd think the words of the Pope were scriptural and right. And he's correct. That would have happened. But God says, seal those things up and don't write those. So God has revealed in the Bible the things we need to know, the things that are proper for us to know. And so we are limited over the overall picture, but there are some things that we can know. He does give us limited insight. In the book of Philippians, chapter 3, verse 20 through verse 21, Paul says this, "For our conversation," which means manner of life, "for our conversation is in heaven, from whence also we look for the Savior, our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body." So our body now is called a vile body. Worthless, no good. Now our body is good for a while. But when we lose our body in death, that body is decayed. It's gone. It disappears in time. Last night on television, there was a show about mummies in Egypt, 3,000 years old. The body can be preserved artificially by mummification and by putting it in alcohol. Things of that kind can preserve the body, but naturally a body decays and soon disappears and you see it no more. Even in a grave, it's gone. So he calls our body now a vile body, but he says there's going to be a glorious body. So the life beyond this one is going to be a complete change, not a physical body, not an earthly body, not like we see now. It's going to be a completely different state of being. Now, when he talks about a body, don't for a moment think you're going to have a physical body. Don't think you're going to have ears or eyes like you have now. He doesn't tell us what it's going to be like. I'm not sure what it's going to be. John tells us that we're going to be like Christ. He says, "Who shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body?" So whatever body Christ has, we're going to have a body like that. I don't know what it's going to be. I can't tell you what it's going to be because the Bible doesn't tell us. But whatever Christ is like now and then, we're going to be that way too. And then Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 7 confirms what we just said. And then shall the dust return to the dust as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. So the dust, your body, what you made out of, is going to return to the dust, the ground. But the spirit, which is the real you, I don't see you really. I see your body. But inside of you is a spirit, and that spirit's going to return to God. So that's the separation. The body goes to the grave. It'll never be used anymore. And the spirit goes to God who gave it. It belongs to him. But the Bible tells us it's going to be a different body than the one we have now. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and you want to turn to read this chapter with me. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 35, Paul says, "But some men will ask this question. They'll say, how are the dead raised up, and with what body do they come?" And of course, that question, as Paul saw 2,000 years ago, has been asked over and over and over again. So, since we're not going to have this body, with what body do they come? Now, Paul explains that in verse 36. "Thou fool, that which thou sowest is not quickened except it die." Now, if you would look at a grain of corn. Many of you are harvesting corn right now. I had some good corn today and yesterday both. And you remember where that corn came from? From that little grain that you put in the ground a couple of months ago. And now that grain has produced a stalk and leaves and tassel. An ear doesn't look at all like that grain you planted, does it? Completely changed in nature. That, he says, "That which thou sowest not that body that shall be, but bare grain. It may chance of wheat or of some other grain, like corn. But God giveth it a body as it pleases, has pleased him. And so every seed his own body." So when our body is destroyed, we're going to come forth in the life beyond this one, not with a physical body, not with the same body at all. We won't look then like we look now. We're not going to be as we are now. We'll have something different about us. And then he goes farther in verse 42. "So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in honor." Dishonor in the sense that it's going to be corruptible. Nobody likes a dead body. Nobody likes to smell a dead body. Nobody likes to handle a dead body. It's a dishonorable thing. In fact, the Old Testament, if you touch the dead body, you're unclean for a certain length of time. He says, but that which we are beyond this life is going to be raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown, notice, a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. We are natural, material now, we'll be spirit after this. There is a natural body and there is a spiritual body. In fact, in the book of Luke, Christ talks further about this in chapter 24, beginning with verse 38. Now, remember that Christ was in the grave 3 days and 3 nights. He has been resurrected now, and he comes and appears to disciples. And here's where he found them, in that room as he appears. Now, they were afraid. They didn't understand. Now, verse 38, he said unto them, "Why are ye troubled, and why do thoughts arise in your hearts? Behold, my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see. For a spirit hath not flesh and bones, as ye see me have." Now, Christ came back with that same old body he had. The same holes were in his hand. The same side was pierced. He came with that same old body. Now, why? Because he needed it for 40 more days. You see, Christ had to have a body to live in because he was living among men. Then when Christ ascended to heaven, he didn't need that body anymore. But while he was on the earth, he needed that body. So he said, now, I am like I was before. I'm resurrected. I've been dead, I'm back to life again, and you'll see me for a while, touch me, feel me, handle me, and know that it's flesh and bone. He said, my spirit doesn't have that. So see, when we go from this life to life beyond, we won't have that kind of body that he has was in then. We'll have a different body. We'll have a spiritual body. But he says now that I have a present body just like I had before. You see, when men are in this life, they have to have a physical body. And that's the reason Christ had to have a resurrected body. Your body will never be resurrected. Your spirit will, but not your body. See, Christ had to have that resurrected body, and the reason why is because he was going to live among men for a few years. This is true also with, you remember, in the case of Mary and Martha. Now, they had a brother whose name was Lazarus. Lazarus died. Now, 4 days later, Christ came to the tomb, and Mary and Martha said, he already stinketh. You see, his body was decaying already. But Christ raised him from the dead. He used that same old body again until he died. You see, while we're on the earth, we need a physical body. When we leave this world, we don't need a physical body. We go beyond this and a body of a spirit. In the book of Luke chapter 20, we find this statement. Then came to the, that begins with verse 27, then came to him certain of the Sadducees, which deny that there is any resurrection. And they asked him, saying, Master, Moses said, if a man take a wife, raise up seed unto his brother. There was therefore, to explain this further, seven brethren. And the first took a wife. Let me see, I'm not reading that properly. Luke chapter 20, beginning with verse 27. Here's where you have a question about the Sadducees trying to ensnare Christ in his language and trying to get him to confuse himself with his answers, which of course he never did. Now, verse 28 says, here's their proposition. If any man's brother die having a wife, he die without children, that his brother shall take his wife, and raise up seed unto his brother. Now, they suppose. There were therefore seven brethren, and the first took a wife and died without children. The second took her to wife, and he died childless. And the third took her, and in like manner the seven also, and they left no children and died. So this woman has in succession, legally, seven husbands. First and died, second, third, fourth, and so on. None of them had children. But now, after all, the seventh husband dies, and she does too. Now, here's the question. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife of them is she? For seven had her to wife. And that's a reasonable question from their point of view, because they don't think there's resurrection. So, Christ, you answer this question, if you could. He says, the children of this world marry and are given in marriage. But they which shall be counted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead, the world we're talking about, the world the Sadducees didn't believe in, but the Pharisees did, and the same thing we're talking about tonight, those who are able to inherit that world to come, the eternal life to come, he says, neither marry nor are given in marriage. So we have then some things about life beyond that's interesting. He said, neither can they die any more, for they are equal unto the angels and are the children of God, being the children of the resurrection. Now, we have here an insight to what's going to happen. He says, in effect, we're going to be like the angels. Now, we're not going to be angels, but he says we're going to be like the angels. Notice this. Angels are different than we are. They were created beings, that's true, but they never died. Angels never sinned. They're in God's presence all the time, except those who did sin, never cast out. Now, when we die because we're humans. And the only way we can ever get into heaven is because we die and are righteous and then go there because the Lord allows us to. He says, now, when we go to heaven, we're going to be like the angels are who never died. He says, we won't die anymore, and we do not marry nor give in marriage. So up there, we're not going to have the relationship we have here. We won't have husbands and wives. There won't be male nor female. There won't be children and old men and old women. We're going to all be as angels. That is, ageless and sexless, but we're going to be pleasing to God because we're faithful to Him and have been redeemed by the blood of Jesus Christ. Now, I think we can understand this, but it needs to go a little farther for us to give a very beautiful understanding about our individual identity there. You remember back years ago when you were a child, there were certain things pictured to you like little toy soldiers. Way back in grade school, I remember that. We had a music class. I don't know how old I was. Third or fourth grade, I guess. And there was a little tune that the music teacher played, and I always loved it. It was the March of the Toy Soldiers. I haven't heard it in 50, 60 years. But it was a beautiful little song, I thought. And in my mind, of course, she made us lay our heads down on the desk, and we could imagine the soldiers marching. And here are the soldiers marching, all exactly alike, all in tune, all in step, all dressed alike, all the same helmet, all the same clothes, a lot of toy soldiers. Now, can you imagine a lot of toy soldiers being lined up on a shelf on the wall? Now, that's not what we're going to be like. We're not going to all be the same, look alike, act alike, have numbers. We're not going to be that way at all. Although we're going to be like angels. But the point is, we don't understand angels completely because they're not part of our present nature here, nor are we theirs. But angels, like we, have individual characteristics. In other words, there are things about angels that we can understand. That is that as your individuals, now look out here right now, I see a lot of different bald heads and some with hair on them and some with glasses and some not, some long noses, some short noses. You are just a whole bunch of different people. And that's the way we are. You have different names, different heights, different backgrounds, different speech, but you're Christians. Now, in heaven, we have angels also like that, in that they have their individual characteristics too. Now, since they do, so are we. Let me see if I can illustrate that to you. Matthew chapter 17, we have verses 1 through 3 that you've heard many times. But I wonder if you've seen this in those verses. After 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them up into a high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them. And his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elias talking with him. Now, this verse tells us that Moses and Elias were talking with Jesus. Doesn't sound very strange, does it? No, it doesn't. Until you realize that Moses had been dead for 1,400 years. And Elias had been dead for 700 years. Now, how could they possibly be talking to Jesus if they've been dead that long? Well, what I want to show you this, very simply, is that Moses and Elias were individuals. And they had their names, and they appeared some 1,400 years later than when they died. They still had their separate identity. Not only that, we find that Peter, James, and John were astonished at those things. And Peter said, Lord, let's build 3 tabernacles, one for each of you. That's when Moses and Elias were taken away, left Christ alone, as you know, and God said, this is my son. We'll build a tabernacle to him, in effect. But the point is, these men who had died and who were righteous men in the presence of God, they had their individual characteristics still. Now, I don't know whether John's going to have the name John Kirby or not, or Ruth's going to have the name Ruth or not. I'm not sure that's going to be their name there. I don't know because the Bible doesn't tell us, but I do know this, that they're going to have separate identities. And they're going to be individuals there, just like Moses and Elias were. So, in heaven, we're going to have our individual identity. We'll be not just one of a great number, but we're going to have separate identities there, just like these two were. And then in the book of Luke chapter 16, as we read last night, verse 23, it says, in hell, he lifts up his eyes, being in torments, and seeth Abraham afar off. So here the rich man saw Abraham. Abraham had been dead for 2,000 years. How in the world could he recognize Abraham? He'd never seen him before. Just like Peter, James, and John had never seen Moses. They had never seen Elias, but they knew who they were. And here, the rich man knew Abraham. So you see, we have our separate identities over there, even as we do now. Matthew chapter 22, verse 30, continues, as we read in Luke a moment ago. It says, for in that life beyond death, the same story that Luke reported, he says, we're going to be as the angels of God in heaven. Now, Matthew chapter 22, verse 29 through 30, we find Jesus answering and said to them, ye do err, not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are the angels of God in heaven. Now let's go a little bit beyond this point, a little deeper, and see some other characteristics. Angels possess their own individual characteristics. I want you to look at Gabriel for a moment. In the book of Luke chapter 1, verse 19, we find that Gabriel appears to Zacharias. Zacharias was the father of John the Baptist. He was the father-to-be of John the Baptist. Now the angel came and told Zacharias that you're going to have a son. Now the angel was Gabriel. Now Gabriel was the angel that appeared to Zechariah. But I want you to notice something else about Gabriel too. In the book of Daniel, we read of Gabriel back then, 500 years before this. You see, Gabriel was at least 500 years old. So in life beyond death, we're not going to have age. We won't grow old. We won't grow weak. We won't have gray hair. We won't lose our teeth. We won't wear glasses because we're ageless. We don't have a body. So since we don't have a body, we don't have the need of these things. Now here's Gabriel, who at this time, I don't know how old he was, but we know he was at least 500 years old because we found him, first of all, back in the book of Daniel. Same thing is true in the book of Jude, verse 9. Now, in verse 9 of Jude, we find this statement. Yet Michael the archangel contended with the devil. He disputed about the body of Moses, and he said he does not bring against him a railing accusation, but said, "The Lord rebuke thee." Now, here we have Michael rebuking the devil, here in Jude 9. And he refers to a time way back at the time of Moses when that happened. Now, Michael, then, you see, had knowledge of the situation about Moses, which, again, had been dead for 1,400 years. So we found Michael, then, spoken of in the New Testament, and he's present in the New Testament age as being also able to go back 1,400 years. Now, no doubt, Michael and Gabriel both were at least 6,000 years old, probably far, far more than that, because they were created in eternity by God before the world ever began. But at least we have a limited time here of 600 as well as 1,400 years. Revelation chapter 12, verse 7 tells us of Michael there, 1,400 years after the time of Moses. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon fought and his angels, they were cast out of heaven. So you find Gabriel mentioned back at the time of Moses. Gabriel mentioned the time of Revelation. So you see, they're ageless. So that's how angels were and how we are. Now, in Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12, we read about another devil. About another angel who is the devil. Here his name is Lucifer. Here Isaiah says, "How art thou fallen from heaven?" Again, confirming where the devil came from. He's here now. "How art thou fallen from heaven?" Where? Revelation 12 says, "To the earth." "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground from which didst weaken the nations?" And so here we find the Lucifer, the devil, also was a fallen angel. But the fact is, he had a name. Notice then, we have individual characteristics. We are ageless. We have names that we can be identified one to another. Now, in the book of Judges, chapter 13, there's a father and mother of Samson. And we have there mentioned an angel, and his name is mentioned, but we don't know his name because it was not told. But it did mention he had a name. So angels had names back in those back in Bible times, and of course, we too are going to be that way. Now, I think this is a beautiful, beautiful proof that we can turn to in Luke 13. Now, beginning with verse 24, reading down through verse 28, Luke 13, here's what we find. "Strive to enter in at the strait, a difficult gate. For many, I say unto you, will seek to enter in and shall not be able. But once the master of a house is risen up and has shut to the door, and you begin to stand without and to knock at the door, saying, 'Lord, Lord, open unto us,' he shall answer and say unto you, 'I know you not whence ye are.' Then shall you begin to say, 'We have eaten and drunk in thy presence, and thou hast taught in our streets.' But he shall say, 'I tell you, I know you not whence ye are.'" Now that's a setting. I notice the next few words, and these words are going to seal our understanding of this matter. "Depart from me, all ye workers of iniquity. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth when ye shall see." They're going to see somebody. He says, now these are wicked. These are condemned. These are lost. And we're in eternity now. We're beyond death. He said, "There's going to be weeping and gnashing of teeth when ye shall see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets, and ye yourselves cast out." Now, I could speculate a great deal on this. Now, I won't go too far. But let me say this. If I end up in hell, I believe this verse tells me right now, I'm going to be able to see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Those who have been reading about and teaching about, and all the prophets. I can see them, and I recognize them, and I know where they are, and I won't be there. What a sad thing that is. But he says there's going to be recognition in life beyond death. He doesn't for one moment mention we're going to be husbands or wives or mothers or fathers. We'll all be saved. We'll be removed from the present limitations, and we'll have arisen to a state of maturity like the angels. That's a beautiful picture, I think. What a wonderful prospect it is to think in terms of the understanding we've just spoken about. And then the Bible tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 9 through 10, but as it is written, I have not seen. So he's talking about something so grand and so glorious and so great and mighty that we can't vision it fully. We get just a small glimpse of it and can't really see the whole thing. This is not a very good illustration, I know, but I just thought of it. Remember back when I was a little boy and my mother was baking a cake, and she'd get all the cake prepared, that is, all the goo out of the pan. She'd hand me the pan and I could lick it. I could get just a little bit on my fingers because she'd use most of it. That's how it is toward heaven. We get just a little glimpse of heaven. The beauty of it, the wholeness of it, we can't see. Whole pan full of goodness, we can't see. Just that little bit on our fingertip. That's all the Lord lets us to see. He said, has not entered into our hearts or our eyes, and certainly not into our hearts, the thing that God has prepared for them that love Him. But He has revealed unto us by His Spirit. The Lord has seen fit to allow us to have just a little glimpse of heaven. But what a beautiful, beautiful glimpse it is. We can imagine that beyond the glimpse we have so far,